I really enjoyed this this book.
Oh, I'm delighted.
I started reading it. First, I looked for 1936, of course. That was the year of my birth.
Right.
And then I began looking for specific dates, people I knew, and this sort of thing. And then I started at the beginning and read it all.
Oh, great. I'm delighted you liked it.
Really a wonderful idea. Tell me a little bit about how this book came about and why you decided to do From Harding to Hiroshima.
Well, I'd never written a book before, but I've always been interested in American history. I guess in my experience with American history as a student, I found all the books fairly heavy, fairly weighty kind of tomes, which really didn't have a whole lot to do with the people, more with the people as they were connected with events, but very little about what made them tick. And so I thought it might be fun to try to write a history book that was fun to read. That and obviously, the Harding to Hiroshima thing is because this period was not all fun. I really used Harding as a contrast. That was kind of the do-nothing days of the Roaring Twenties, and everybody was reacting to World War One, and we didn't like it, and we were glad to be home, and we were isolationist, and speakeasies. It was a very easygoing time. So the title was chosen just to contrast it with Hiroshima, which is probably the most devastating, terrifying, perhaps, thing that happened in that whole span. So it is a book of contrast, but I've tried to deal with it with kind of a light touch, although you certainly can't deal with the Holocaust or things like that with a light touch, but I tried maybe to get into some of the people-related aspects of it.
Well, I think it's important for you to show the things that were going on in the world, even though you whether touched on them lightly, and then how people did other things in the context of
right.
a particular time.
Right.
It's very important in the period during the Second World War. You do outline the major battles and everything, but meanwhile
yes.
you're talking about things people did on the home front.
Sure, sure.
Right. Now, just to go back a little bit, you said you wanted to start with Harding. That's 1923. But that still sounds like kind of an arbitrary date. I mean, why didn't you start
well,
1900?
It could have started absolutely anywhere. I decided on Harding because at the time, strangely enough, Harding was incredibly revered, and when he died, as it says in the book, was mourned like no president since Lincoln. History has revealed him, I think. Arthur Schlesinger puts him in last place as qualification or in terms of how effective he was as a president. So I guess I decided on Harding as just a contrast and just decided to start with him. It could have started in 1920. Perhaps might have been more logical, 20s, 30s. It could have started really anywhere.
Well, the alliteration in the title.
And that's another
thing. There was a new book that came out last year called Chronicles.
Yes.
That was, of course, not like yours because it's really a listing of things where actually you have text and a narrative. But that was a very helpful book. I keep that, as I will with yours, on my research shelf. Because
it's extremely helpful if you want to go back to a particular year and find out what was going on in that year. And they also do some offbeat things in there. I mean, it is the major events, but they also pay a lot of attention to major people who was dying at the time and, you know, whether they're movie stars or artists or whatever. I enjoyed it. I mean, I can't tell you that I've read it all through, but I've looked and I have used it as a reference work. It's a terrific piece of work.
I see you quote a lot from Frederick Lewis Allen in this book. I think his book was called Only Yesterday, wasn't it?
There were a number of them, but Only Yesterday is probably the best known. Yes, I think he had a wonderful facility for not only dealing with major events, but telling you what people were doing at the time, what they were eating, what they were buying, some of the sociological things that were happening, and doesn't confine himself to, just the major things that the government was grappling with. It's a lot of fun, and he's a wonderful historian. And another one who was particularly good, who wrote a wonderful history of the period 1932, I think it ends in 19 somewhere in the 60s, is William Manchester. who wrote, and I'm not sure, I'm probably going to get the title wrong. It was The Power and the Glory, or The Glory and, no, The Glory and the Dream, it was. Mm-hmm. And if you want a wonderful source book for yourself to add to that Chronicle thing, and it's, you'll find it in paperback out there.
I missed that one. I know
it's fabulous.
About Lincoln and, and the president.
It's just fabulous, and covers a lot of very off, well, while the D-Days and things are going on, he gets a lot of human interest stuff along
now,
with it.
This is an anecdotal history. Now, how did you start compiling all of these anecdotes?
Well, it was kind of a hobby. I'd never written a book, and I never really, I always wanted to, but I wasn't sure I could do it, so I just kept throwing this thing in a drawer somewhere, and I got more and more of it, and finally I got to the point where I said, you really have to do something about this, or it's beginning to lose its meaning. But I'm lucky enough, I have a very good friend who's one of the foremost historians in the United States, David McCullough, who wrote The Path Between the Seas, the Panama Canal book, Mornings on Horseback, Teddy Roosevelt, The Great Bridge, on the Brooklyn Bridge, and if it hadn't been for him, I never would have gotten it down on paper. He said, look, the stuff is interesting. Write it down and see where it comes out. And then he kept pushing me along in the project. I think for a lot of people who haven't written, writing is intimidating. And what this taught me, and I'm not saying this is a beautifully written book, because I'm sure others could have written it better, but that if you know something about a subject or gather some material, don't be intimidated. Give it a try, because you may have accumulated, it's not that hard to accumulate a lot of information on a subject and really bring some authority to what you write.
Of course, it was helpful for you in terms of writing by organizing it the way you did, because you
yes.
had the major events, the personalities, sports,
absolutely.
All of these things, and you could group these by subject matter.
Absolutely. The people were the fun of it, though. I mean, I just... at random. I mean, I write about hundreds and hundreds of people, but I just put down a few names.
Well, let's talk about
just to show the variety.
Index cards there.
That's
right. Give me a few names of.
Well, I really picked out a few to show the contrast. But Harry Houdini, Texas Guinan, Einstein, Shipwreck Kelly, the Loch Ness Monster, Pavlova, Mickey Mouse, Barney Oldfield, H.L. Mencken, Davy LeRoy, Tommy Manville and Barbara Hutton, who were the husband and wife collectors of the era.
Now, wait a minute. Who was Texas Guinan?
Texas Guinan was the, coined a lot of words like hello, sucker, and she was the speakeasy queen. She was paid $3,000 or $4,000 a week, if you can believe it, in the heyday of the speakeasies. And in New York City, always had the most popular place. She had some chorus girls, but basically she was, you know, the person who knew how to insult patrons, and somehow it was the in place to go. Another word she coined was Big Butter and Eggman, which I'm, you know, is now become kind of symbolic of the big businessman kind of type. But she was a very glib lady who was extremely famous. That she'd been in the movies. And she came back, and she ran saloons for a man named Larry Fay, and about every, who was a mafia gangster attached kind of guy, and about every month they'd get closed down, and they'd open another one, and she was the real hit of the speakeasies at the time.
Now, you mentioned H.L. Mencken. I was shocked when I was talking to someone close to my age the other day who asked me, who is H.L. Mencken? The subject came up. But what do you say about H.L. Mencken? Who was H.L. Mencken?
Well, H.L. Mencken was first a newspaper man and writer. Strangely enough, he stayed pretty much in Baltimore, although he edited with George G. Nathan, a very powerful commentary at the time called American Mercury, which was very popular during the 20s. H.L. Mencken... was acerbic about everything. I mean, he coined the word Bubus Americanus. He basically wrote off the Middle West and anything that wasn't New York City, and was critical of almost anything that smacked of pomposity, profit. He attacked everybody. He took everybody on who was at the time. And along the way, he wrote some terrific books that are almost textbooks on the use of words and stuff like that. But he was very, very famous and got an awful lot of people irritated, was the darling of the intellectuals. Unfortunately, when the 30s came and the Depression came, the American Mercury went. I think it was considered too frivolous a magazine at the time when the country was suffering so much.
Did I hear you mention Shipwreck Kelly?
Well, Shipwreck Kelly was the great flagpole sitter. This was a time of...
Why would somebody want to do that?
Well, it was funny. I guess because it was a time when there was no television, and people... He would go around and sit on a flagpole atop a hotel, say, in St. Louis, and sit there for, you know, I don't know, 30, 60 days, and became famous, and people were mesmerized somehow watching him up there sitting on this flagpole, and was a really a national celebrity at the time, if you can believe it.
How about Wrong Way Corrigan?
Wrong Way Corrigan was... and it's still debated whether he really meant to make that mistake or not. But Wrong Way Corrigan was a pilot who wanted to, who Lindbergh was his great hero and wanted to emulate Lindbergh and wanted to fly to Europe solo the way Lindbergh had done. But he had a terrible old plane, and the civil aeronautics people didn't want him to go alone, didn't think he could make it, so they told him he couldn't go. He then went out to Floyd Bennett Field and said, "I'm flying to Los Angeles." And turned around and directly, I mean, even the manager of the airport saw him take off and heading for Europe. And he ended up in Dublin. Now, he insisted all the time that he made a terrible mistake.
Just a compass error.
Yeah, a little compass error. And I must have...
Probably thought he was flying over Lake Michigan.
Well, that's right. And it lasted for a long, long time. But they never prosecuted him for it. I think somehow there was a little sympathetic streak in them. It's amazing he made it. He just dumped down in the center of Dublin.
Now when you started compiling these little stories and anecdotes about people, did you do it because you didn't have a book in mind? You just began collecting these things because you were fascinated by these little tales.
Well, and I thought it might be a book, but I do like trivia and some of the offbeat things. I can give you a couple of examples from the book. One that amuses me is the Mellon brothers were big industrialists from Pittsburgh, very stodgy, wealthy men. Andrew Mellon was Secretary of the Treasury under Harding and Coolidge, and his brother Richard ran the whole family fortunes back in Pittsburgh, which were considerable. But strangely enough, these two fairly stodgy men had been playing practical jokes on one another all their lives. And in 1933, Richard Mellon was dying and summoned his brother to his bedside. And as he went in the room, and it was quite obvious to everybody, this poor gentleman wasn't going to last very long. He beckoned him over to the bedside and closer, and then finally he said, "Keep coming closer." And when his brother was really right up against him, he tapped him on the shoulder, and he said, "Last tag," and then died, leaving his brother eternally it.
Tag you're it.
Kind of amused me. Another one involves Huey Long, who... the great politician, demagogue at the time, who Roosevelt said was the most dangerous man that he knew of alive. But during the 30s, he not only owned Louisiana, but he was really, during the Depression, getting national recognition. The words, "Every man a king," he was going to promise a guaranteed income and all that. And this is before he was assassinated. But once Huey, who was the politician of all time, was down in southern Louisiana and to make a speech in front of the Democratic group there, and the local man said to him, "Now, Hugh, this is an area which is almost 100% Catholic, so I'd hope in your words that you could recognize that." And Huey said, "Well, I'm not a Catholic." He said, "Well, look, just, you know, forewarned is forearmed." So Huey got up and he said, "I'm delighted to be here this morning." He said, "You know, when I was a boy, I got up in the morning and I took my Roman Catholic grandparents to Mass. I hitched up the buggy and I took them down there, and then I came back and took the buggy and took my Baptist grandparents to church." So after the speech was over, the person came up and said, "Huey, I never realized you had Catholic grandparents." He said, "Hell, we didn't even have a horse." So
those are wonderful stories, and you can go on and on, but I think the reader can find for himself how funny the world really was, in spite of all of the calamities, and poverty, wars, depression. By the way, I see Isaac Asimov presents from Harding to Hiroshima. How did Isaac Asimov get into your act?
Well, quite by chance. The publisher was a good friend of Isaac Asimov's and gave him a copy of the manuscript to read. And he said, I really like this. I'd like to write the foreword to the book. So that's how it happened. I'm sure his name is on the jacket because it's better known than mine.
doesn't hurt. And the publisher is?
Demner Books.
Tell me about Demner Books. I'm not familiar with them.
Demner Books publishes about 30 books a year. Red Demner, who's the publisher, was the circulation editor of Newsweek for many, many years and decided to get into the book business. His books are distributed by Morrow. And I think he just enjoys the publishing business. He's done about 30 books a year, which is very, very small as publishing houses go. But
well, your readers would also be delighted to know that the book is indexed so that they can look up the stuff they're interested in, and it's well organized, well categorized. It's a very interesting book, and I certainly enjoyed it. So, Barrington Boardman, thank you very, very much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
About the book.